linguistic art chips.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And if you've been wondering why this podcast is several days late in coming out this week, well, I think I'm going to blame it on Neil Kramer. You see, last week my wife and I attended one of Neil and KMO's couch surfing salons, I guess they call them, and I heard Neil say that every so often he takes what he calls a technology break. No computer, no internet, no MP3 player, no TV, nothing electronic. So I tried that this week and found it to be a wonderful way to relax. You see, we've been having some rainy weather here all week, and in fact, I just heard that our county has now received almost one half of our annual rainfall, which is about what Tampa, Florida gets during an average summer week of afternoon thunderstorms. But rain is really rare here in Southern California, and so I enjoyed curling up with a good book in front of our electric heater and listening to the rain as I read. And now I'm looking forward to doing this some more, without the rain, of course. The only problem I've discovered with disconnecting from the net was that after 2 or 3 days offline, it's really difficult to come back to sitting in front of a computer. It's as hard as it was for me after returning from a week's vacation in Mexico or somewhere. So that's why I'm blaming Neil for my newfound sloth. But Neil, you're also to be thanked for slowing me down a bit. However, in the interim, some of our fellow saloners didn't slow down. Instead, they sent donations to help offset some of the expenses here, and these fine saloners are Michael R., Craig A., Colin F., Sam S., Adrian D., Eric C., who, by the way, very thoughtfully sent a donation to Haitian Relief in the name of us all here in the salon, so thank you for including the salon in your generosity, Eric. And we also received a very generous donation from Jeff M., who said, "Should have done this a long time ago. You said you were established and solid, so I donated elsewhere. But I'm sure every little bit helps, and for what you have given, I'd like to try to reciprocate. Thank you seems inadequate, but thank you, Jeff." Well, Jeff, Eric, Michael, Craig, Colin, Sam, and Adrian, well, hey, thank you for your help and support, both now and in the past, because I know some of those wonderful donors have been making contributions for several years now. And although we've never met in person, I feel like we're old friends every time I see your names. So, hey, thanks for being here. And guess what? Our program today is also a gift from some of our fellow saloners. And I first learned about this event through a Facebook email, which read in part, "I have been a 3-year listener to the podcast and can say that they have truly changed the course of my life. I'm an anthropologist, and because of your podcast and some of the others that it has led me to, I have shifted my focus from basic medical anthropology to the anthropology of psychedelic culture. I am now an anthropologist of the tribe, so to speak." And let me just put in a little aside here to say that, to my knowledge, Dr. Cameron Adams is now the first anthropologist who is focusing on what we all call the tribe. And I wish you the greatest success possible, Cameron. And his email goes on, "My first public and professional foray into this new endeavor was a session my wife and I convened at the 3rd International Conference for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture at the University of Amsterdam, 23 to 26 July 2009. The conference was called Religion, Nature, and Progress, and our session on Friday, 24 July, was called From the Shaman's Circle to the Ivory Tower, Progress, Spirituality, and Psychedelic Thinking. We recorded the session, and I wondered if you'd be interested in checking it out for a possible podcast. Also, I thought you may be interested because we are academics working in the field of psychedelics, have given lectures or lecture series on psychedelics and cannabis in university classes, and have one student doing this work and at least one other in the pipeline. You have said some rather accurate but disparaging remarks about university, but I think this is one example of the little steps of change that can happen. Also, the University of Kent has ratified a student psychedelic society. I take no credit. This is the labor of love of one of our very turned on and sincere students. And this society will begin in earnest at the end of this month. Another little step, but definitely worth keeping an eye on. Thanks for opening up a good road and for doing the good work, Cameron. And Cameron's full title is Dr. Cameron Adams, School of Anthropology and Conservation, University of Kent, Canterbury, England. And the three speakers that we are about to hear, you know, in order of their presentations, are Anna Waldstein. And Anna is a lecturer in medical anthropology and ethnobotany and convener of the BSc in Medical Anthropology, School of Anthropology and Conservation, University of Kent, Canterbury. Ivan Castleman, and at the time Ivan was a master's student in the SAC-UKC, and Cameron Adams, of course, who is an honorary research fellow in the School of Anthropology and Conservation at the University of Kent. Also, I would like to give special thanks to Nexus 112, who helped edit and improve the sound of the recording. So now let's join Anna, Ivan, and Cameron as they take us from the Shaman's Circle to the Ivory Tower.
So when we were coming up with this, we were trying to sort of decide what to call it, and we all sort of agreed that we like the term psychedelic thinking, and just kind of refreshing everyone's memory. It means mind manifesting, and that it's very similar to shamanic practices and shamanic thinking techniques of having psychedelic experiences, as we saw from the video, are very, very old and, you know, like any sort of evolutionary ideas. We obviously have no direct evidence, but through careful work, determined that these techniques are very, very old, particularly the use of plants. And so the psychedelic experience, which is very similar to mystical experiences, religious experiences, are sort of just the beginning of what we think about as psychedelic thinking. And so the thinking really comes in with taking these experiences and reintegrating them into our lives and into our work. And, you know, it's basically very creative, holistic, ecosystems thinking. It's related to movements such as deep ecology and things like that. As far as people have been able to piece together, humans have evolved in environments where we had lots of access and exposure to psychedelic substances, and also given the nature of pre-human and early human society, would also have access to sort of seasonal fasting and seasonal fluctuations in diet, and, you know, sort of experiences of living outdoors, observing the heavens, sitting around fires at night and staring into flames and basically bringing on these meditative techniques. It's been hypothesized that they induce hypnotic states, and that certain people who are susceptible to going into trance or hypnotic states perhaps provided an advantage in that these states, by certain skilled or observant individuals, could be used to affect healing or could be used to come up with solutions to other crises in the lives of early humans. And so shamanism is argued to be the oldest form of religion, and by shamanism, the definition I'm using is basically, you know, sort of animistic religions where you have sort of semi-professional, but sort of individuals in societies who were perhaps a bit more tuned in to psychedelic experiences, or were, you know, just more interested or more observant or more thoughtful about these things. Then in small-scale societies, would sort of arise as shamanic practitioners in whatever sort of flavor of shamanism they've taken from across the world. Now, these techniques continued as human evolution went on, and human populations started to grow, and people started to settle down and grow crops. Cities grow into larger societies. These techniques continued, although of course, you know, the forms changed and social hierarchies, you would get there would likely have been more specialization, people specializing in these techniques, perhaps similar to what we see in some shamanic societies today. So things, even state societies like ancient Maya, Aztec, that's sort of my area of expertise, so I'll talk about them, continue to use shamanic practices. There's evidence of things like mushroom stones and other sort of things that look like paraphernalia and traces of using psychedelic substances from the classic Maya period, which was 700-900 AD, and then again later among Aztec societies as well, although we have some ethnohistorical evidence that it was even more hierarchical and perhaps more restricted, those techniques were more restricted to the sort of priestly upper class. And then eventually in the West, things really started to change. Social stratification became more intense, and you have the development of sort of the church state, and early Christianity sort of gave way to the more formal church. Necessarily name any names. But the suppression of mysticism, psychedelic experience, psychedelic thinking began roughly 2,000 years ago in the West. And you get more intense socioeconomic and socio-spiritual hierarchies. And access to these techniques of thinking becomes more and more restricted until you get society like today, where there's state control of consciousness, as well as state control of production and many other aspects of life. And of course, throughout the history of Western civilization, as we're all familiar, it's not necessarily a pretty history. There's conquest, there's colonization, there's slavery, and much of that is still continuing on today. However, one thing changed, and that this sort of the state became secularized. And more recently, you get the rise of corporations, and you get globalization, a sort of huge world economic system, industrialization, basically cocoonment in the built environment, so being cut off, not spending as much time outdoors, not spending time in nature. And then more recently, you get things like overconsumption and affluenza. And so the long-term outcomes of this is, as you know, we're all more and more aware, global climate change, global financial crises, pollution, toxicity, disease, violence, and what's looking more and more like an inevitable collapse. You know, all civilizations rise and fall, and it looks like this one that's been going on for several thousand years is sort of coming to an end. But what that end will look like and what will take its place remains to be seen. And it could be a very catastrophic Malthusian collapse, or it could be something a bit less devastating. And so I'm going to now turn it over to Ivan to talk about contemporary psychedelic practices and that sort of thing, and then Cameron will talk a bit more about literature and philosophy and psychedelic thinking, and then we'll have a discussion.
My name is Ivan. I'm an ethnobotany student at the University of Kent. I'm studying a plant called Salvia divinorum. It's a short-acting hallucinogenic plant from Mexico. It gets mixed in with the Mayan. They've got three. They've got morning glory and mushrooms and Salvia as well. Salvia has moved into the West and is used in a very different way. I'm going to show you a video quickly just because this is what I study, and so it'll sort of wrap it and make everything in context. So this is just like a 2-minute clip. This is posted on YouTube. This person has just consumed, well, about 2 minutes ago, consumed Salvia, and these are sort of some of his ramblings as they come up.
I don't know, man. It's a trip. It was so beautiful.
I was
scared, but it makes me understand things. Like, it guides me to places far away that are not here, or don't exist, or existed before, or will exist, and I'm just walking through it. being part of it, witnessing what's taking place, an event.
There you go. Now you're understanding.
An event always takes place somewhere out there. We just gotta be the looking. We gotta be sitting down, just enjoy what the villagers are doing, or the Hawaiians are doing, or the Indians in Mexico are doing, or the people, the Indians from North America are doing. Indigenous people of all kinds of the world, even blacks. I just feel like there's one unity of all these indigenous people, like living a simple life, telling us that we should live like they do. Like that simpleness to the earth, that's what earth wants. Earth wants that us to be that children again. And now we just ruin it with gasoline and oil.
So on YouTube there's 900 videos. If you Google Salvia Divinorum, there's 900 of these videos. And they vary from this, which is a very sort of like open-minded, expanded consciousness kind of thing, all the way through to kids that don't know what they're doing and they break windows and stuff like that, and a whole range in between. I've watched about 100 of these videos, and it's sort of part of ongoing research. But what I want to talk about today is how, like Anna's talked about, the how traditional shamanic practices, they're still alive and well today, but the power elite have definitely started to, well, they've essentially eroded a lot of the power out of those experiences. But part of the human neural architecture, something in there makes us seek this experience, and redefine it and recreate it and then re-ritualize it. As I think, now this, I'm sort of at the preliminary stage of data analysis and stuff like that, but what I'd like to hypothesize is that this sort of small phenomenon on YouTube is a type of re-ritualization. So Anna talked about the power elite, and during that pass off of power from the church to the monarchy to the state, and now from the state to the corporation, we've seen this incredible erosion of psychedelic practices, consciousness expansion, all that kind of thought. And as far as this sort of conference goes with progress and all that kind of stuff, if we're really to sort of re-engage in the creative and innovative power that the human mind is capable of, we're going to have to start looking at traditional practices and how they relate to modern practices, but also to start to study these new ideas and these new practices that are emerging basically right under our noses. The power elite continue to try to erode this kind of stuff, and they, I mean, it goes right from killing the shaman to convincing populations, especially the new media right now. They're very good at convincing people that they don't need this anymore. They're incredibly good at convincing us that we need a new car and that new shirt and the toys for our kids or whatever, but very good at also convincing us that we don't need this type of thinking anymore, this psychedelic thinking. But despite the power elite's attempt to eradicate this, it bubbles up. I mean, we saw an example of this in the 60s. The 60s kind of peaked and fell off. I have some ideas about that, which I'll talk about at the end. But the power elite doesn't want us to think like this because it disengages us from consumerism. It connects us with the environment and makes us start to question what's going on with pollution, overconsumption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it also makes us question the status quo. And the power elite really, it's important for them, for us to accept the status quo. We want to vote and we want to work and we want to have a beer after work and go to bed and do it all over again. And that's really what they try to, get us in the cycle. They really want us to keep us there. So, if we're thinking differently, if we're engaging in creative thought, this isn't such a good thing for the power elite. Now, as I mentioned before, the power elite has tried to erode these kind of practices. And a lot of modern religious practices have their basis in these early shamanic practices. But what's happened is they've kind of hollowed out the core of the ritual. And so on the surface it looks the same, but the meaning and the power of the rituals has been taken away to maintain that, to maintain that power. Now, there's, Anna talked about the more traditional practices, and these traditional practices have sort of morphed into and moved into a modern day manifestation. In Brazil, at the Santo Daime Church, which is a new ayahuasca practice. In the 1930s, saw the rise of the Native American Church, which is a Native Americans. It's based in Haiti. And then in Africa, you've got the Iboga cults as well. And these are all traditional practices practiced in a modern time. And so you have this trajectory from the traditional to the modern. And whether by consciously or unconsciously, humans seek this psychedelic thinking. In the West, we've seen a rise of things like yoga and meditation, and then Salvi Divinarum, which I study, is a sort of fast-growing trend as well. And whether people know it or not, they're seeking out those ideas, because nobody forces you to go to yoga or you don't sort of walk out of the store and somebody hands you Salvi Divinarum to smoke. You have to seek out those type of experiences. And we seek them out from a very beginning. Early childhood experiences of rolling down the hill, experiences of dizziness. One of the very first consciousness expanding practices that we experiment with. And then, like I've mentioned, the yoga and the Salvi Divinarum. The Salvi Divinarum is different because the practice, the traditional practice and the modern practice are totally separate. There's no similarity between the two. And so this is really interesting for sort of like these new rituals that humans create in order to make sense of their psychedelic practices. So Salvi Divinarum, short-acting hallucinogen from Mexico. Aztecs have used it from contact till now. It entered into Western academic interest in the 60s when Watson and Hoffman brought back a botanical specimen and it was successfully identified. And then sort of it was this kind of mythical third plant of the Aztecs for quite a number of years. In the mid-80s, two groups found the active ingredient, the active psychedelic ingredient in it, Salvinorin A. And so from there, it took another 5 or 6 years for them to say that, yes, this was the psychoactive property in this plant. And they also figured out at the same time that you could smoke this. So we're into the early 90s right now. And so we've got the early 90s, people are starting to discover Salvia, and at the same time, we've got the rise of the internet. So this Salvi Divinorum phenomenon, it's not out of the question that there's a whole bunch of videos on YouTube, because this phenomenon actually has risen with the popularity of the internet. And again, I'm just at the preliminary part of my data, trying to churn it through, but what I'm seeing right now is that people posting on YouTube, they're posting outside of a ritualized context, but in posting on YouTube, they've started to create their own rituals, and the internet is very integrated into that. So the differences between the Western practices, the modern practices of Salvi Divinorum, and the Mexican ones, in the West it's smoked, in Mexico it's chewed, and in the West it's mainly self-administered, normally with the help of a friend, but in Mexico it's almost always administered by a shamanic, so it's part of the shamanic practices. In the West, it's an experiential practice. So, like, I mean, people are using it just to experience it, whereas in Mexico they use it for ritual. They use it for shamanic training, they use it for divination, and they also use it for some curing ceremonies. And then, of course, the geographical differences are large due to the fact that it's only in the Oaxaca Valley that Salvia divinorum is found. So you've gone from this very state of Mexico to a global phenomenon. So YouTube is a really interesting part of ethnographic and anybody studying people right now, YouTube is a huge array of cultural information. It takes up about 20% of all the HTTP traffic on the World Wide Web, which factors down into about 10% of all internet traffic. Think about having something that's 10% of all internet traffic. It's a pretty large and dominant cultural force right now. Just a little stat: every minute, 10 hours of video is uploaded on YouTube. So, and this footage on YouTube, it's largely amateur. There's a couple, like some of the big news corporations and stuff like that, and governments have YouTube sites, but it's largely people like us with a video camera with something to say. So as I go through all of this YouTube data, I've spent weeks and weeks and weeks watching YouTube videos. There's about 900 hits for Salvia. So when I started and I typed in Salvia, there's 300 hits. This was in January. And now I did it today, and it was 10,500. So just in that short time. Now, these are not all unique videos, but these are the hits that YouTube is bringing up on their internal search engine. So that's quite a change from 300 to 10,500 in 7 months, right? So we're seeing a large growth in this phenomenon. The videos on YouTube, highly criticized by the media, of course, and politicians. A lot of congressmen in the States quoting, well, I've seen it on YouTube, and they dig up these, like, one or two of the worst videos they possibly can. I classify about 85% of the videos that I watch on YouTube as a positive experience, as in that there was no physical appearance of distress and no verbal sort of help or anything like that. There are a few videos that definitely display people not having a very good time, but the majority of them are positive, and it's really hard to tell whether or not that, like, I don't know where the, like, people like Fox and stuff like that, of course, cruise through all these videos and put up the very worst ones, but it's a very small percentage. So the top four videos, YouTube, again, talking about this growing phenomenon, there's 6 million views between the top four videos on Salvia divinorum videos on YouTube. So 6 million views is quite a substantial amount of attention. Enough to warrant at least a sort of small part of this research. So there's a few reasons why Salvia divinorum and YouTube have found a match together. Salvia divinorum is short-acting hallucinogen. So if you smoke it, the better part of your experience is going to be maybe 15 minutes maximum. Normally it lasts about 4 to 7 minutes. So the YouTube time limit of 10 minutes fits in really nicely with that. Largely in the West, it's legal to sell, possess, grow, smoke. You can eat. You can basically do whatever you want with it. Some U.S. states are slowly starting to make it illegal, and Australia has also made it illegal. And I think Spain has said no. But largely, it's readily available in shops, but also online as well, which adds to its internet focus. So now we have the confluence of psychedelic thinking and the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web, I don't think itself is a mode of psychedelic thinking, but I really do believe that it will factor in more and more into both the spread of new ways of psychedelic thinking, but also to sort of facilitate the ritualization of new ways of psychedelic thinking. So we have this loss on one side of traditional psychedelic thinking, but on the same side, we have to make sure that we're exploring the new ways that we are displaying this and ritualizing it. And I was trying to find a sort of a title for this and all that kind of stuff, and never actually ended up finding one. But sort of, it's almost like the internet's like the new oracle. And an oracle is kind of something you have to give and take, right? You can't just ask it and expect to receive. You have to sort of give to the oracle as well as receive. So more on that later. But the internet's really a really dominant force too, because everybody gets their say. It's sort of this new way of talking to the world without having as much subversive force placed on you. So print media, video, all that kind of stuff, it's all been filtered through the corporations. Whereas the internet, you've got a computer, no problem. You've got a voice. And your voice can be as loud as the corporations or the governments if you so choose. So what do I want to take from all of this? Humans are adaptable. And although we see that this loss of traditional shamanic practice, this traditional psychedelic thinking, on the same time, we have the rise of other types of practices. Now, if you talk to a lot of people and you watch a lot of these videos, you can easily make the assumption that, oh, these are just a bunch of kids, they're smoking something new, they're getting out of their mind, they're not, you can devalue their experience all you want. But if you look and you search, there's something in here. And again, at the preliminary part of my data, I don't exactly have solid conclusions, but I know that there's more in here than just a bunch of kids getting high. So as humans face this crisis that we're coming up to shortly, 100 years from now, who knows, the power for our minds to create new ways of dealing with these things, we're going to be forced to do this more and more and more. So whether it be a small phenomenon like people posting videos on YouTube and slowly creating those rituals, or if it's a massive psychedelic revolution that everybody in the world turns on, it's one of the many possibilities that might help us pass through this next hurdle in humanity. So I think that really what I want to sum up with this whole thing is that there's traditional shamanic practices, there's spiritual practices that are they're old as time itself, but at the same time, as humans adapt and humans create new rituals, we place we embed these new ways of thinking into various types of texts. This is one of them, and then the other one Alan's going to talk to. So that's my bit. Thank you.
All right, I'm Cameron Adams. I am, by training, a medical anthropologist, so I'm walking out on a limb here. Something totally new and a little bit more fun for me. Though it does have some stuff that is related, and I'll talk about that at one point. These are somebody else's notes. I, like Ivan, have become fascinated with the internet as a place to study people. Except for I'm a little bit more old-fashioned, a little bit stodgier in my ways, and infinitely older than Ivan. And so, a whole 7 years, I believe. And but I've been looking at podcasts, which has been their... supported by the internet. These are people who put up talks, lectures, music programs, whatnot. It's like a radio program that you can subscribe to it, pull it down, listen to it when you want. There have been a whole bunch of them on psychedelic topics, and you can get hour-long, two-hour-long lectures on these topics, which for some reason turned me on. I can sit there and listen to a talking head for a few hours. but also forums where you can discuss this stuff in the very old-fashioned method of print media in much more of a discursive way. Though I do not want to discount the discursive nature of YouTube, and I need to talk about this a little bit more. But there is a dialogue there. It's not just posting a video. Now, I've got a whole list of psychedelic podcasts of various sorts, from very rational to very freaky, if anybody wants those in a little while. But what I'm going to focus on mostly is the history of modern psychedelic philosophy, sort of a trajectory, as opposed to some pretty old stuff. I mean, we could go all the way back to Plato, who very many of his ideas and stylistic points could be retreated to the Eleusinian Mysteries and Kaikion, which may or may not be an ergot-based beverage, which would be similar to LSD. Somebody has come up with a very simple way of making it non-toxic using ash, so it would have been easy to do. So Plato is a little bit earlier than what I want to talk about. And also, I'm missing some of those old guys, Thomas de Quincey, classic opium eater literature. William Blake is a visionary poet. And Samuel Taylor Coleridge, another visionary poet. I don't want to go as far back as that. I mentioned this is a very old tradition in the West. But I want to start with stuff specifically related to psychedelic drugs and what came in the West. And I'm going to start arbitrarily in the 30s with Alan Watts, a very spiritual guy, studied comparative religion, Oxford, and did a lot of very straightforward religious analysis. Until he had taken LSD and found, wow, this stuff gets me to the same place meditation, these deep methods do, and started writing about these issues and speaking about them. And this began a mixing of science and spirituality at that time. It started becoming this analytic approach to the spiritual experience and trying to understand it analytically and the psychedelic experience. Now, this was taken up much more strongly by the ever-famous Aldous Huxley, who we all know, Doors of Perception, his personal favorite and novel being Island, which has a psychedelic vision, a utopian vision of a possibility. And so with these guys, you start getting in, especially with Aldous Huxley, this very science-driven idea of the psychedelic experience. And so we can take this, we can look at it, we see what it does, we get these ideas about how society should be, how we should treat the raising of children in a very sort of analytic way. Now, Aldous Huxley also felt that psychedelics should only be reserved for the elite, the intellectual, the Illuminati, basically. I don't think we would call themselves any way it's used today. As opposed to a sort of democratized thing. Now, much more recently, this mix of science and spirituality, or the psychedelic influence, has been sort of culminated in the work of Dale Pendle, who's written three books, Pharmacopoeia, Pharmacognosis, Pharmacodynamics, based on very pharmacologically driven terms from the field of pharmacology. And basically they take series of mind-altering plants and discuss them in a very complex mix of history, chemistry, botany, poetry, experience reports, etc. Mixes them all up, and you get a very rich sense of what this plant is that neither science nor pure poetry can give you. It gives you this really complex insight into them. It's particularly good for people who've never done them and trying to get an idea of what they're like. Though he covers, he's not just psychedelic plants, pharmacognosis is, pharmacodynamics is stimulus, and he just goes through a whole variety, and if he's taken everything he's written about, he's somebody who can do things that most humans can't. But that's where you're getting this mixing of science and spirituality. This starts in the 60s, going into scientist philosophers like Timothy Leary. He's this sort of went from psychology, got into the psychedelic thing, sort of denied psychology to some degree, came back to it. Starting with him in his later work, but also Robert Anton Wilson, who was a very stringent Leary supporter, you start getting teleology in this scientific thinking. Now, those of us who are embedded in science understand teleology is a dirty word, four-letter word, especially if you're thinking evolution. There is no goal to evolution, it just happens to you. There's a goal orientation to it. These psychedelic thinkers start bringing teleology into it, and this culminates in Timothy Leary's ideas of SMILE, which is S-M-I squared, L-E. Space migration, intelligence increase, and life extension. We are on a path towards these things. And these are evidence in what he calls our eight-circuit psychedelic or psychological model. And there's various aspects of the brain, four of which are currently activated, and in the left-hand side of the brain. And then there's all the right-hand side of the brain. There's four other circuits that can be activated through psychedelic plants, but there are future evolutions. We're moving into them. So there's a teleological view, where eventually we'll be space-floating cognitive entities. Escape our bodies, and some pretty wild stuff added to it. But that's the teleology between the eight-circuit model and the SMILE. Now, he says we're at stage four, halfway through. Now, Robert Anton Wilson works with Timothy Leary, or works on his ideas. I don't think they necessarily ever met, but he started in the 70s and came up with ideas such as reality tunnels. And I think this is a very useful thing to think about in terms of psychedelic thinking. Reality is a very complex thing, multifaceted thing. However, our experience is traveling in a tunnel or a track through this broader reality. Those of us who are called anthropologists use a nice technical word for that, ethnocentrism. We have our cultural models that we think are right, we go through them. And so this reality tunnel plays into this. And he starts having sort of a fight back against the scientific dominance, of scientific thinking, by coming up, Robert Anton Wilson, this is, with irrational rationalism, or as a lot of people are starting to talk about, scientism as opposed to science. The flat-out belief that science is the only way that is worthwhile of knowing the world. He's not denying science as a very, very useful way of knowing certain things about the world, but he has a problem with people thinking it's the only way. And he came up with the fantastic statement that the world is stranger than we imagine, so we shouldn't believe in anything. Belief is when you deny the input of data, evidence. If you start believing, you don't need the evidence, and then it's something different than science. Now, this brings us essentially to a turning point in psychedelic thinking. I'd like to think of it as BT and AT. And that T is Terence McKenna, the ever famous Terence McKenna. This guy was so powerful of a speaker that while you're listening to him, it is very hard to think there's anything wrong with what he's saying. I've listened to, I believe, 30 hours of lectures of this guy, and every time I was sitting there listening, and about a week later, I'm like, that idea was a little bit weird. That doesn't hold. But he's very charismatic, and he can draw you in. And he is the foundation of much of psychedelic thinking that has come since. And basically, everybody wants to be Terence McKenna, now that he's died in the new team. But he took Robert Anton Wilson's The World is Stranger Than We Imagine and amplified it a bit. The world is stranger than we can imagine, even And so the psychedelic drugs, in his idea, are the only way to get beyond that. Now, what I see as this tying into the Robert Anton Wilson stuff is reality tunnels. I like to think of them more as trenches or tracks. The psychedelic experience, be it induced through meditation, be it induced through fasting, trauma, or using plants, lifts you out of that trench, out of that groove, in such a way that you have a better holistic view of what's going on. Now, that experience in and of itself can be quite mind-blowing and very difficult to bring back. I think a very good way to do it is spend more than a few weeks on vacation but in another culture. The anthropological experience is often designed around experiencing another culture, finally getting it, so that you can understand how arbitrary your own is, and you can come up with a better analysis, social analysis of what's going on. Break down these ideas of ethnocentrism. This is a fast way, the psychedelic experience is a fast way to get up out of those groups. Now, another sort of interesting thing Terence McKenna said that I quite like is when we get out there, we're like fishermen in a sea of consciousness. And the goal is not to cast your net and catch the Leviathan that will rip your net and maybe drag you into the sea and never hear from you again. It does happen. And the goal is not to catch the tiny minnows of consciousness that make you realize, now isn't it the most amazing thing that your pinky finger fits right in your nostril? That's the middle-sized fish of consciousness. They're this job to work towards bringing material back that is significant, but you can't get the stuff that we simply can't handle. And from his point of view, it is a role in society that someone or individuals need to become engaged with. And he worked often enough with a biologist, Rupert Sheldrake, who I believe some of you probably heard of, who's still doing quite interesting work, and Ralph Abraham, one of the guys of chaos mathematics in what they call trilogues, which they have various discussions with each other and people would come and listen to them. And I'll get to Rupert Sheldrake when I get to the sort of culmination here. Now, from these ideas at this point, I'm going to give a quote that I have, and it's a real quote, it's a fictitious quote, it's a quote of a fictitious person, a fictitious book that's in a magazine. It's kind of psychedelic in and of itself. But it says, it is too constricting to say that you must always think outside the box, which is what we currently count as psychedelic thinking to some degree, corporate psychedelic thinking. Whether you are thinking inside or outside the box, you are still letting the box dictate your thoughts, are you not? What you are not acknowledging is the honest fact that the box itself is figmentary and illusory. And as long as one continues to act in reaction to this perceived set of dictates, one cannot be truly original in thought. So once we're stuck in those grooves, even if we like want to walk on the top of the groove or the bottom of the groove, it's still going down that same path. This is attributed to Erica Amelia Smith as in an address to the nature of proper uses of technology in Steampunk magazine. So it's a literature magazine. And I think this is, again, this idea that getting out of any kind of groove that you find yourself in is the best way to find solutions to the current problems. Now, Terence McKenna started bringing in this teleology much more. They would come out of these grooves and they would see patterns and attribute significance to them. I think this is quite related to, I hope I haven't been here, yeah. Some research actually done here at the University of Amsterdam, quite serendipitously, if you're here, but I don't think you are, if I mispronounce your name, please forgive me. Deichterhaus did a study of decision making. And they basically said, here's a variety of things to make the right decision, you know, the best decision out of them. And they had half the group sat and thought about it, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever it was. The other half played chess. And at the end of the time, okay, which one? The ones who played chess made, as a group, better decisions than the ones who cogitated on it. And the interpretation given, of course, this interpretation, we don't know if this is what's going on, is that when you consciously approach a problem, you go down well-worn paths. The project, the choice was deciding on what kind of car, which is the best car out of this group. Well, when you're deciding what kind of car to get, what do you think? Fuel economy? Is that more important than the comfort of the captain's chair? Is that more important than the color of the vehicle, the horsepower? But you make choices. You immediately make choices before assessing everything because you're trying to solve the problem. Whereas they suggests that the subconscious mind takes all the factors equally. And therefore, the color of the interior, the space of the boot or trunk, are equally assessed with fuel economy, etc., and then relatively graded after the fact as opposed to pre. And so therefore, a more rational choice, more holistic decision can be made. Again, this ties into what's happening with the psychedelic experience, with looking at things outside of your groove more holistically. You can see, okay, that's an arbitrary path. It might be of interest. That might be of interest too. And you get a very sort of everything is equal. Now, unfortunately, this can also lead to the over-assessment of the value of unimportant aspects. And this is why we say the psychedelic experience is not enough. You've got to bring it back and use it on the ground. Now, Terence McKenna talked about the eschaton. 2012. Rick back there knows all about this. He's lived amongst the Mayans himself. In 2012, the Mayan calendar, apparently, according to some people, will end. And it's the end of the world, according to some people. But something's going on. And Terence McKenna came up with a chaos sort of graph, graphing of chaos patterns in the King Wan version of the I Ching, and took this and mapped it against history, found peaks and troughs, compared to what you called novelty and lack of novelty, and the whole thing collapses at 2012, if you map it to historical events. Maybe, maybe not. Of course, there's a lot of ways to do this. And so this has become a major theme in a lot of the teleological thinking among the psychedelic community. The idea is something will happen in 2012. What will happen? The vast majority of these folk, and I think idealized by a Daniel Pinchback, is that this will be a good thing. 2012, something good is happening. The world will change. Society will change in such a way that we'll all be better for it. And this basically ties into Timothy Leary's smile, space migration, becoming beings of light, going into these higher realms of mental functioning. And, you know, there we go. Perfect. Bruce Damer talks about this as if the universe itself is becoming a conscious being, and we're only part of it. And this ties into the Gaia hypothesis, Teilhard de Chardin. But that as the world, universe is becoming more conscious, 2012 is when we go into a higher stage of the universal consciousness. And again, we're just part of it, so things will be quite nice. And this seems to be a nice thread through. Eric Davis takes this in a slightly different way. Says, yes, in 2012, things can be pretty good. They can also be pretty bad. He doesn't really talk about 2012 so much, but this future point. And he makes the very important statement that imagination is the key to what will occur to us in the future. Imagination. And it's the imagination is also that interface between humans and the natural world. Now, as a quote here, any kind of restorative, sustainable renewal of our power of our planet, rather, has to exist on the imaginal realm as well as the realm of the technical solutions, political developments, and technological fixes. It's a multidimensional problem. And by implication, that multidimensional problem requires us to be able to see outside of our two, three-dimensional realm. Four dimensions. Those of us lucky enough to be able to think in the long term have four dimensions. And he takes the stance that from the psychedelic experience you get visionary art, but that needs to be worked with and become visionary design. And so we can use these visionary ideas, these new ways of thinking, but apply them to society. So we can't just sit around and wait for the eschaton of 2012 and things will be great. We gotta do it. And we gotta do it creatively because the way we're doing things right now isn't helping. It's where the problems are coming from. And he sort of goes and hassles these other sort of guys that see that 2012 is going to be a really good thing by saying dream of a better time ahead is dreaming of a better time ahead is natural to the psychedelic experience. However, it's dangerous, a temptress that keeps us from being active in the change itself. So again, we need to take this psychedelic experience. We can't just look at it, assess things equally, and say, okay, things are going to go in a certain way, can go in a certain way, but we got to take that information back. Instead, we need to bring it back. Bring back the insights piece by piece to build a new world. And so this is where I'm going to stop my particular bit of this talk leave it up to you guys and see what you guys have to say. Questions?
Anita? I would actually even sort of continue what Cameron's saying by saying that each psychedelic experience is different, period. Like, per person or like the individual have a variety of different types of experiences, and then you'll have a different experience than the person sitting beside you. I've gone through a number of rituals as well as just sort of the experiential stuff as well, and every time it's different, every time things come out. And I think the most important part of those experiences is that it's not the experience itself, but what you bring back from the experience and integrate into your daily life. And I think that's... So I would definitely not consider myself a lumper at all, more of a splitter, but it's infinite possibilities. But it's taking those infinite possibilities, using them creatively, bringing them back. Because, I mean, we can't spend our entire existence in this psychedelic realm because it's very difficult to function on a day-to-day basis. It's a place that we go and we bring it back by integrating those experiences into our daily life. But that creativity and that innovation is going to help, hopefully.
Okay.
Do you see a difference? I'm just interested by seeing.
Okay.
Do you see a difference between the effect of doing the psychedelic drugs as opposed to people who do the psychedelic experience and say meditation in terms of how it the experience is brought back and expressed within the community?
I mean the short answer would be yes, there certainly would be certain differences. Having psychedelic experiences with the help of drugs is very, what is the word, ergonomic? If you take the correct dosage, you will achieve a psychedelic experience. Whereas other practices, you have to work at them for a long time, and part of that working at it for a long time often involves living a lifestyle that is more dedicated to those practices, so perhaps living a more monastic lifestyle or a more sort of lifestyle that incorporates those things. And so certainly, like, the experience you get with taking psychedelic drugs can be more disorienting, and you have perhaps a more difficult time for many people reintegrating. Whereas if you're achieving them through other means and you're sort of living that lifestyle anyway, of course it's going to have an effect on how you interpret it and what you bring back and how you share it with other people and how you, like, if you're living in a community of you know, meditative, contemplative thinkers, then the way you communicate with other people in that community is going to be different.
But also, you also prepare yourself for the experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody reaches enlightenment meditating, you know, in 2 weeks. You engage with yourself and you work towards it. And so whatever the experience, it builds up very slowly. And you essentially, as a lot of the talk in the Kundalini community is you prepare your nervous system for that. And if you get there too fast, it can be harmful. And in a lot of ways, the thing goes, it can't quite often be that lightning bolt, but a little bit too fast for anybody to integrate. But also, by living in a community, or at least being aware of a meditative community, contemplative community, you have a structure with which to interpret your experience, which is in a lot of ways missing in the psychedelic drug community, the drugs in particular. I mean, a lot of people, just some guy on the street, one price an answer, yeah, sure. You know, and there may be some thinking about doing it before doing it, but there's not that sort of matrix or milieu in which to interpret the experience. And so this is some of the discussion about the difference between our emerging urban shamanism, as some people like to talk about it, versus traditional shamanism where there's a community. Little kids see people on Ebene and, you know, with the young mom. They know the experience, they know what to expect, and are able to sort of surf the waves of experience that come with it because they know what to expect, they know what people come out of it. Whereas a lot of people, the first time they take these things, it might be the first time they've even seen it. And so there is a vast difference there. And Alan Watts talked about this with having achieved what he thought was an illuminated state to some degree through meditating, and the same state through LSD. So they're very similar. And that they are of a kind to some degree. And he suggested the use of both techniques over with each other as a way of making that a more robust and useful experience. And but then there's been, ever since, quite an argument between the, no, you got to work at it and do the contemplation and meditate. No, that never gets you there. You got to take the drugs and blah, blah, blah. And there's this big argument between those communities with some people saying, well, they actually can't integrate with each other.
There's an original magazine. We used to call it Enlightenment. Now it's called Enlightenment Next. You know, you buy health food stores and stuff in America. But there's an article about that very issue in the last issue of the magazine.
So
I really enjoyed. But if a man is talking about taking a particular drug, I don't remember which one versus enlightenment.
Sure.
But which one do you think is going to have more, if you're talking about this in terms of changing world consciousness to deal with the looming crisis, which one's going to have more power? The one that's being within a structure, within a community, or the people I know that have done salvia do it individually. They do it on a Saturday night at a party. I don't know what you mean by ritual, but there's no ritual besides, you know, bringing out the bomb and stuff. But and I'm not against salvia in any way. I think it can be very powerful, so I don't mean to be derogatory in any way. But which is going to, you know, and then I think what you're saying about the 6 million views, so I guess it is getting out to a very large community, but is that community going to be able to bring it together in a cohesive way like a shaman would do in a community?
As far as which one's better, I'm a yoga instructor or a teacher as well as have plenty of experience with various psychoactive plants and different traditions and stuff like that. And the door to perception is the same door, but there's just a lot of different keys that open that door. So, but it's not necessarily like if all of us did one thing in this room, it's not necessarily going to be the best or the worst. It's really up to the individual because it's a very individual experience. So it's up to the individual to find what works best for them. The woman that taught me how to be a yoga instructor had, maybe touched a drop of wine twice in her life, but other than that, like no caffeine, no Tylenol, no nothing for her entire life. She eats fruits and vegetables, and that's it. Well, and some other things, but and she's very much against the whole psychedelic experience. But she's an enlightened lady, and she definitely thinks in a psychedelic way. And again, I've worked with shamans from Peru, and they do ayahuasca on a regular basis, and that works for them. And they have the same, like, it's incredible, because these two experiences were separated by time and space, and very, very similar conversations that are created with the same people. One that has never done psychedelic drugs, and one that has done a lot. So it's really up to the individual to pick what works best for them. And having experienced both kind of living in an ashram and as well as psychedelic experiences, I know the key that works better for me are things like salvia, because I find that in a meditative community or in those sort of groups and stuff like that, you don't end up with any contrast. So you're having all these great experiences, but everybody else is having all these great experiences, and there's no contrast. So I find it harder to sort of interpret and integrate my experiences. And also in those same communities, you have this very structured way of integrating. So it's not allowing you to sort of develop and form your own way. It's a very cultured way of integrating. So sometimes I've hit walls a lot in my both my meditative and my yogic practice. I've hit walls, and I've tried to push these walls and push them, and I can't do it because it's a very structured way. So it's all about finding your own special key.
Then there's people like me who find that the quick way doesn't really do it, because I feel it's not the real thing. It doesn't take work deep down inside. And so 20 years of meditation will be a much more rewarding experience for me, just because I had work that way. I have that reward for effort type of experience that makes it the real one. And there's a lot of people just like that.
You don't necessarily want to just have one experience either. Like,
no.
The more you can put into your experience, the better.
Personally, for me, the main thing is anthropology. Like, I grew up among anthropologists and psychedelic thinkers who used a lot of psychedelic drugs, and experimented a little bit myself. But it was really just sort of growing up within the mainstream American culture, but outside of it as well. And really the way I do it mostly is I teach anthropology to students and like try to get them to think outside of their groove or reality tunnel or whatever, and basically cracking open their minds through teaching anthropology and encouraging them to go out and live with other people and things like that. So, I mean, it really, the forms are almost infinite. But I think the main thing is to step out of the reality tunnels that we're on, particularly coming as an American, coming from this whole corporate overconsumption, uncontrolled growth, manifest destiny, we're going to the moon, and all of that, I think, is what keeps me up at night. So.
Yeah, but some of these guys can't go to the moon.
Right? Yeah, I know, but it's different. It's different. Going to the moon without rocket ships, whatever. But, you know, like, basically taking all the resources of the Earth to build big rocket ships. Did you?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask guys about, with my PhD research, well, I'm doing a part-time PhD at the university, and I'm a secondary school teacher, so I've come into contact with people using salvia and lots of different ways of doing it. So, do you not think that, I think part of what I picked up from all your presentations was that psychedelic thinking is like an answer to, or a possible answer to, things like commodification and consumption, but do you not see that might it not be possible to argue that the current resurgence, the current widespread use of salvia and its appearance on the internet, and the fact that you can just go online and buy it, represents the fact that attempt to commodify psychedelic experience in the
net. So. Absolutely, yeah.
No, the ayahuasca tourism.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and we're talking about drug tourism, just like going to see the shamans and stuff like that. And there's always that part of it for sure. But the interesting part about salvia is that you buy it and it's commodified and all that kind of stuff, and then you take it. And even though you're participating in a and it's much the same way with drug tourism, you engage in that consumer behavior, but then as a result, you end up with the possibility of having sort of a new mode of thought at the end. I can tell you that after watching how many of these videos and talking to people and all this kind of stuff, that not every, like that video that I showed you was a very special video. Like that was like, and it sort of encompasses everything that I hadn't expected to find, but was glad to. But I mean, there's a lot of kids that are they buy it, and because their friends did and they saw it on YouTube, they just want to try it out and all that kind of stuff. And whether that those experiences become useful at the end of the day, or if they're just a drop in the bucket in the whole realm of their existence, and they never think about it again. But I mean, the potential to spark a new ways. But the commodification of those kind of like of smart drugs is a whole other subject. Fascinating, but at the moment it's outside of what I'm researching and stuff like that. But I do agree with you. I actually agree with both, like both the drug tourism and the commodification of all these things are a problem. Yeah. So I mean, it's but the answer is never really. It's not a black and white kind of yeah. So interesting.
I was going to mention just sort of in passing that this commodification of going into this stuff and what can happen, they can be used in very specific ways. And I think, you know, if you approach something with a particular goal, you're going to probably find a way to achieve that goal. And so if somebody, evil world, take the world over type of control person, it's not going to suddenly become an ecologist after some sort of heavy experience. You know, they might find a way to screw people over even worse.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of the way you apply these things. And I was talking about these reality tunnels. You know, popping up and seeing things holistically doesn't make it nice. But if applied in certain ways, now Myron Solaroff in the 60s and James Fadiman used mescaline as well, roughly at the same time, to study goal-oriented use of these things. And this one with LSD was about creativity, kind of increased creativity, which everybody agreed, yeah, sure, okay, all this, they're taking it, blah, blah, blah. The mescaline one was a lot more interesting because they said, okay, try to solve a problem. And they had a physicist, an architect, a bunch of other people said, solve a problem. And it was used basically to make money. And so this can be done as well. The insights can be commodified as well as the experience. And so one of the physicists apparently was one of the guys who figured out how to get particles to go around a curve in one of these particle accelerators through this mescaline thing. Now we have CERN, 40 years, 50 years later. What's that?
Crick.
No, that wasn't Crick. Well, Crick also apparently figured out DNA while he was taking LSD. He's admitted it eventually. The architect just saw the building in his mind completely with all the bolts and everything, the type of bolts, and drew it up and built it, sold the house. You know, so this can be used for that type of stuff as
yeah.
well. So it's not simply the psychedelic experience, but that type of being able to come up above gives you infinite amount of options where you only had, say, 50 or whatever. It's a way to get out of the same sorts of the technologies that we use that got us to this point aren't going to get us back out of it. And so people who apply it to that task are the ones who will be able to use psychedelic thinking in such a way to get us out of it. You know, Bill Gates will just figure out how to make a better computer system. That's what he knows. That's what he, you know, lives. And if he has a transcendent experience, it's all going to come in from his experience computerized. Yeah. And a lot of these computer guys did apparently take
yeah.
Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, all them. I don't know if Bill Gates
not
is
Bill Gates now.
But yeah, all the Macintosh guys admitted it. But you get sort of
and they have a far superior product.
Yeah,
gotta say something.
But there's also little evidence of psychedelic thinking out there. I don't know if any of you know about Free Cycle, which is an anti-capitalist or sort of pseudo anti-capitalist. If you don't want something anymore, you tell them. And somebody else says, yeah, I'll take it, I'll repair it, or, you know.
They come and they take it away.
They come and take your stuff away, but it's being used. It's not just going in the landfill. And it's a really quite radical idea. Give away your stuff, and somebody else might give you something they don't want any longer, and it becomes this network. And we participated quite a bit. We've gotten a few things that I wanted, and I've gotten rid of far more things than we want. Stuff you think don't become American outlet appliances in the UK. They're useless. I mean, you have to go in and completely rewire them. People want them. But I find that a very psychedelic thing, whether or not it was involved in any kind of drug use thing. And I don't want to, and I don't think any of us want to actually make it sound like we are advocating particularly going out and finding salvia or going out and finding mushrooms and taking it. There are different routes to a psychedelic perspective. And again, it's taking back these weird ideas we have, dreams, you know, whatnot, our ways of bringing this stuff back.
I think, you know, personally, my... is not, again, not to advocate these things, but just to take them seriously.
Yeah.
And you know, as academics or whatever our careers are and whatever our work is to take it seriously and to really listen and to think about it and, you know, tell people about it, write about it, and things like that.
And I've certainly seen a lot of evidence of 15, 16-year-old kids that shouldn't be doing this at the particular time. Like, and... in a traditional context, when salvia is used, the shaman acts to put people through the ritual, but the most important part is that they help interpret the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring them out, but that's what the real lack of sort of knowledge base that we're missing is, because people are seeking out these psychedelic experiences just as part of our natural human sort of like inquiry, but then we don't have the sanctioned teachers anymore to help us do something with it.
As the guy Lorenzo, who started our video, said, he wrote a book called The Genesis Generation. And so basically, we are the Genesis Generation. We're the beginning. These kids screwing up on YouTube, doing even the dumbest things, are possibly the shamans of the next generation. And they're going through and making the mistakes so that others don't have to. And this may be something that's emerging, urban, modern shamanism. It may be happening through these phenomena. Especially, I think salvia is very important, being short acting as well. Who these days has 12 hours to give up to self-exploration? 15 minutes is sure attractive. And it may be an issue with the timing of how these things are coming in, that actually fits our culture much better than LSD does now.
Yeah.
And why, not just that it's fits on the YouTube video, but the YouTube videos are also 10 minutes long, because that's something about the way we think about things. People don't want to put up with more than 10 minutes of stuff.
Well, I think it's great that you guys are doing this research, because I think a lot of us who are experimenting with these things feel very isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And the more it becomes like... academically legitimized or whatever, the more people will be willing to talk about it and not keep it.
Hope so.
Well,
I don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, exactly what you were saying earlier, because people just think you're wacky.
Yeah.
So you keep things very hidden, and then you feel very isolated in what you're doing. It's kind of a relief to find that there's a
whole. There is a thread of the psychedelic community that thinks we've over-sanitized it and ruined it completely.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Well, first of all, let me say that I sure hope Cameron's terminology catches on among anthropologists, where he classifies events as BT and AT. Before Terrence and after Terrence. Thank you for that, Cameron. You and your associates, by the way, have restored my faith in academia. And may your shining examples encourage more young professionals to become involved in studying the extremely broad field that the word psychedelics encompasses. Near the end there, I think it was Cameron who said, there are different routes to a psychedelic perspective. And that, I think, hits the nail on the head. You might be surprised at how many of our fellow saloners have never taken a psychedelic and who have no intention of ever doing so. Their interest is mainly in hearing about these great ideas that often arise out of the psychedelic experience. And I'm sure that these new thoughts, in fact, even cause a form of psychedelic experience when first heard by many people. For me, psychedelic thinking is about even forgetting that there is a box to think out of. And don't you think that this young group of psychedelic thinkers did an excellent job of getting their audience out of their academic grooves and push us all a little further along in our experience of this life? Like you, I suspect, I sure would have liked to have been there and to have added my comments at the end when the discussion began. There was a whole range of issues raised there that I'm sure we could have talked about well into the night. In particular, I'm fascinated by their investigations into the current evolution of psychedelic practices, or rituals, if you will, that have little or no connection to the more ancient rituals involving these plants. And I'm in agreement with the general idea that while the ancient forms are being recognized and honored, they all had evolved long before the world's human population was anywhere near the size it is today, and before we were all so interconnected by this thing we call the Internet. Even just 50 years ago, news of our sacred medicines and how to use them was almost impossible to find. Yet today we see people using psychoactive substances on YouTube. There simply is no precedent for the times we're living in. So you'd better strap yourself in and get ready for even more acceleration. At least in our level of discourse, for sure. And speaking about a high level of discourse, that is exactly what I found at the Salon or Couch Surfing Tour, or whatever you want to call it, that KMO and Neil Kramer have been conducting up and down the West Coast here. And once I get back up to speed again, I'll try to organize my thinking a little better about what Neil and KMO have begun, and how maybe we can all begin participating in these live gatherings with out leaving our own hometowns. So stay tuned, and if you've got some ideas of your own on this, I'd love to hear about them. But before I forget it, in this presentation, we just heard Cameron Adams speaking about the importance of Aldous Huxley's later work as regards the topic of psychedelics, and I completely agree with him on this. What I would like to comment on, however, is the fact that, just like you and me, Aldous didn't come to his first psychedelic experience in a vacuum. He had, in fact, already had well over 50 years of life experience before his first use of a psychedelic substance. And so once again, if you have an interest in Huxley or the very early 20th century mindset about the use of psychedelics, I highly recommend Sybil Bedford's brilliant biography of Aldous. It's just not to be missed, in my opinion. And one last comment about the talk we just heard is that the recording that Cameron sent me, on it there was also another half hour or so of Q&A that included some rather critical comments that I decided to delete. And not because they didn't pose interesting questions, but because the people making some long-winded comments, at least to me, seemed quite ill-informed. For example, one person, an older anthropologist, it sounded like, was so out of date about indigenous Amazonian people that she equated ayahuasca shamanism with witchcraft. Need I say more? Well, once again, I find myself with more notes, emails, and things to say than I have time for, since today's podcast is already overly long, I'm afraid. So I'll once again move these notes to next week's program and get to the post-production processes and get this online before the weekend. So again, I'll close this podcast by reminding you that this and most of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are freely available for you to use in your own audio projects under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial ShareAlike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And if you are interested in the philosophy behind the Psychedelic Salon, you can listen to my novel, The Genesis Generation, which is available as an audiobook that is downloadable at genesisgeneration.us. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.